Welcome to the Crexy Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm Ashley Kopovich, Regional Director at Crexy, and today's host. Each episode, the Crexy team dives into a broad range of topics and conversations with featured experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news in commercial real estate. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining us for this special episode of the Crexy Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. Today, we are thrilled to sit down with James Ang, National Director at Old Capital. James has over 15 years experience in commercial real estate lending, starting his career as a loan underwriter at GE Capital Real Estate prior to joining Old Capital in 2015, where he is currently the national director. He has worked with hundreds of investors to help them acquire over $1 billion in multifamily properties, totaling over 14,000 units nationwide. James combines his finance, risk, and investor background to find the best loans for clients to be an indispensable advisor throughout the entire life cycle of a deal. Often called the professor of multifamily financing, he has produced hundreds of hours of educational multifamily content on YouTube. In addition to financing multifamily, he has invested in close to 10,000 units as a limited partner in nearly 30 properties in Texas. He received his finance degree from the University of Texas at Austin and now resides in Dallas-Fort Worth with his wife and three boys. James, welcome to the podcast. Let's dive in.
Thank you, Ashley, for having me.
Of course, we're so thrilled. You're definitely a treasure to have, and we're super excited to get into it today with you. So we'll just start right in with our first topic. So I'd love for you to share with our listeners, how did you first get involved in financing and kind of where has your career path led you?
It really started at GE Capital, and I came out of UT Austin, and they basically put us into a rotational program. And from there, I got to work in Connecticut, I got to work in Colorado, and then I moved to Dallas. Through that sort of 6-month rotational program, I landed in commercial real estate. And one of the nice things was I was the youngest guy in the office. Most people had 20 years of commercial real estate experience. And I was just sitting there like a sponge, soaking it up. And so what was nice was that you got to learn from sort of industry experts. And I was only really like a year out of school. And so I was on the finance side in terms of being more like a CFO for the business. And then I really wanted to learn the underwriting side. Because that's where, as a lender, that's where you make the decision, okay, do I do this loan or do I not do this loan? And so I moved into the underwriting side, and that's really where I cut my teeth sort of 2007 to 2015. And through that, we had the Great Recession. And so when you're a lender and you go through that, that sort of allows you to figure out what types of deals are going to do well and what types of deals aren't going to do as well. And so throughout that whole time, we took back in terms of foreclosed on office, industrial, retail deals that just were over leveraged. And, the two types of properties that we did not take back at such a high level were really multifamily and self-storage. And so when I was looking at investing on my own sort of in 2015. Those were the two property types that I really started looking into was multifamily and self-storage.
Got it. Thank you so much for that overview. That was great. So maybe for some of our listeners who are trying to get into this sector, maybe newcomers or some transitioning into their career path, what were some of the methods that they can take right now? Obviously, with you and GE, you were kind of thrown into this and had the ability to intern at a couple of different spots and really find your niche and your passion. But what would you say to people who are maybe trying to get into the sector? What are the methods for them to jump in?
to me, I think you have to have some sort of skill set. And so what I came in with was sort of a finance background. So I had my finance degree, and then I had done finance rotations throughout different GE businesses. And so I had just sort of the understanding of the P&L, the understanding of the business. And so I think that's what you have to do, because each one of these properties in commercial real estate is like a little business. And so you have to understand revenue and expenses. And so I think you're going to have to, there's a lot of components of commercial real estate, right? So there's listing brokers, there's finance guys, there's property management companies. And so figure out which one you like and which one sort of fits your skill set, and start working at one of those places. Because I think experience goes a lot further than sometimes just the education that you can do at school.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, on the job learning is second to none. When you're doing it yourself or learning through your peers and your team members, of course, the formal training will help as well, but there's nothing compared to that. So kind of testing the waters and all different things, I think would be beneficial. When getting into lending, what were some of the fundamentals, James, or first things that you learned when you were diving into the business kind of head first like that?
I mean, you know, at the very basic level, it was going to see every property that we underwrote. And so in, you know, when I was an underwriter, I usually just got one property or one loan a month. And so that allowed me to dig in significantly deeper. And so that would mean, you know, flying to the property or driving to the property if it was local, understanding that submarket, understanding the tenants. Like if we did an office building or retail building, understanding the tenants and the leases behind it. And then, you know, a lot of times when you underwrite a property, you're going to get third-party reports like engineering, environmental, and sort of putting all those reports together. And so I think, you know, from an underwriting perspective, we used to have what we called like a credit request memo. And this was like a 30-page document, and it outlined everything about the property. And so starting with the sponsor to the property, to how we underwrote the rents, the rent comps, the sell comps. And so after you do that about five or six times, you start getting it. But just understanding the nuances of each property type and each submarket is how you get better. And so when I was at GE, you know, I might be doing a office building in Phoenix 1 month, and then I'll do a retail building in Houston. And so it was more of a broader base. And so I relied on appraisers, I relied on listing brokers in that market to tell me sort of what the comps were and sort of how to underwrite it. But, you know, what I've done now the last 5 or 6 years at Old Capital has really been focused in on multifamily, number one, but then also had a pretty hyper focus in Texas. And so what that allows you to do is as soon as someone calls you about a deal, most likely you've looked at that deal in the last 5 years. And you underwrite it, you know the rents, and you can pretty much tell the value of the property just by the name, the year built, number of units, and the location, and you're pretty much there. So I think you have to sort of pick and choose. You're not going to be able to do everything, right? So you know, if you're going to go pretty narrow into either a property type or a market, I think that's actually probably where the best investors are.
I love that. That was kind of leading to my my follow-up question on that, where you shared some of the strategy at GE plus at Old Capital, where at GE you would definitely fly to the place, do all of your research, and now maybe you have a little bit better of understanding of the market. So you can do that kind of off the cuff. But what are some of my other ideas or principles or strategies that have been the most useful throughout your entire career?
I like to think about, like Scott Adams has an idea around skill stacking. And what that essentially means is it is very difficult to be number one in the world at something, right? So if you want to be number one at the, I think it's the 100 meter sprint, you got to beat Usain Bolt, which is pretty dang hard. But if you can do it in 10 seconds, you're like pretty good, right? So the way I like to think about it in my career is, you know, I had the finance background at the beginning. I added sort of underwriting, and then I added investing. And just those three, not many people have. Most people are just a lender, or most people are investors, right? But not, it's sort of rare to have a finance guy and an investor. And then to add on to that, I would say the third skill is really around marketing and getting better at advertising. So, you know, Old Capital, we have a podcast, we have a YouTube channel, we have a conference that we put on annually that has 500 or 600 multifamily investors that come to Dallas. So we have multiple things that I think when you stack all those together, like nobody does that. And so I think that's what you have to think about a little bit with your career is how do you take a skill set that you're already good at, right? So when I was at GE, there was nobody saying, hey, you should really learn more about multifamily investing or go tour properties on the weekends or at nights and start getting to know listing brokers. It was all on you, right? And it was more, you have to have that passion and you have to have, you know, a drive to learn that, because there's plenty of people who worked with me at, let's say, quote unquote, a bank, even though GE Capital was not a real bank, but like, there are plenty of people who are in finance positions that work there sort of 8 to 5 and they never invest in a property. They never go out and try to understand that piece of the puzzle. They just sort of stay in that niche. So to me, if you want to expand, you have to know a broader skill set and bring that, because now if I ever change sort of my role, I can go work with an investor, I can go work at a bank, I can go work at a marketing company, all those things. But then you have the background in all these facets, which makes you pretty much indispensable, is what Seth Godin calls you.
Oh, that was beautiful. I think that you hit on so many different things there. And one of my key takeaways is matching it up with a phrase that I like to use. So I'm in sales, James. So the classic sales line is always be closing, right? I like to change that to always be learning, right? You're never going to be the best unless you learn everything and you continue to want to grow and continue to want to have those skill sets, not just the ones that are going to be able to help you do your job now, but branch out so that you can, you know, kind of open up all of those doors for you. As you were just mentioning, you can go and work in a lot of different roles and clearly be successful. So that's amazing. And just one life tip that I appreciate you sharing with us.
Yeah. And I mean, just to add to that, I mean, the, you know, a lot of people, they will follow me on whether it's they listen to 100 podcasts and watch 15 videos and I'll never hear from them, right? And then, you know, all of a sudden they hear about a deal and they call me and I don't have to sell them anything, right? It's already like, all right, here's the property. I'm buying it for $5 million. I need a $4 million loan. James, you know, figure that out. And, you know, I've never talked to him before. Right. So I think, you know, in this day and age of, you know, YouTube and podcasts and things like that, I think you have the ability to replicate yourself and people can listen to these things. I mean, I don't know how many emails I get between the hours of midnight and 3 a.m. And it's emails from people who have watched, you know, they're binge watching my playlist on YouTube. So, I mean, it's a constant machine that's always going for you.
Absolutely. And hitting on another perfect point, you know, especially in this day and age with technology and with different ways to market yourself, you know, what is really truly going to make you stand out? And you have the ability to go ahead and do that. You know, your YouTube is amazing. It's so educational and you become almost a personality and a brand and, you know, the market expert. So everyone does know you. And for everyone listening out there, you can definitely do that for yourself. You just have to take the action, like James is saying, to, you know, want to have that passion and drive to go ahead and do that. So it's beautiful. Thanks for reminding us about that, James. getting into, you know, your current role, what exactly does your day-to-day look like working at Old Capital right now in your position?
Yeah, so Old Capital is a mortgage broker. So we help investors really find the best debt for their acquisitions and refinances across sort of the commercial real estate, you know, spectrum. But majority of our focus is on multifamily. And so what that really entails is figuring out what type of loan is the best execution right now in today's market for that specific investor. So if you're coming to us and you're trying to buy a $5 million property, you know, we might get you a $4 million Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan, or maybe a bridge loan, depending on your business plan. So we talk with the investor, we review the property's sort of financials, T12 rent roll, and then we go out and get quotes from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, bridge lenders, and bring it back to you as the investor. And we show you the options, but then we also give you our opinion of what the best execution. And, you know, our job is to make sure that that loan goes from beginning to closing, and we get paid $0 if that loan does not close. So we are incentivized to get you the best loan possible at the best terms. And then what really happens is, you know, as people do more and more deals with us, we become sort of not only the loan guy, we become, all right, can you go out and look this property? Like, we've had clients from California, from New York, call us and say, hey, can you go look at this property in Dallas? And we'll drive by, do a video, do pictures, and like give them sort of an overview of that deal, and you know, just become more of an advisor throughout the entire transaction.
Thanks for that overview. That was a nice understanding of your day to day, as well as the company and what you're doing for, you know, your clients that are reaching out to you. And that's a beautiful segue. So maybe some of our listeners are unsure what the different types of loans that are out there and available to commercial real estate investors. So just diving into the financing itself, would you just give us a basic overview of the different types of loans that are available?
Yeah, I mean, let's start with multifamily, and then we'll do a broader sort of broader range across commercial property types. So on the multifamily side, most people are going to start out with a recourse bank loan. So a recourse bank loan is really for your first-time investor. So this is a loan that's typically under $5 million. It's going to be 5 years, maybe 1 year interest only, and then 20 to 25 year amortization. And it's going to be recourse to you. So if there's any foreclosure, then they can come after your personal balance sheet. You know, most people, when they move to commercial, they're thinking everything's non-recourse. So non-recourse being you are not responsible if you get foreclosed upon, they can't come after you, right? So if you move over to non-recourse, it's really Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the more stabilized lenders. But with that, what they mean by stabilized is 90% occupied for the last 90 days. And they want you to have some multifamily experience. So previous multifamily ownership experience, 5 units and above, you can get Fannie and Freddie. And then on the far side, as you get more and more experience, you can do what we call non-recourse bridge loans. And those are typically 5 million and above, and it's for more experienced operators, and it is shorter term. So it might be a 3-year term, and the interest rate might be a little bit higher than Fannie or Freddie. So right now it might be 4 to 5% on those bridge loans, and they have a shorter term maturity. And so that's on the multifamily side. That is where we typically play. I would say probably 60 to 70% of what we do is on the Fannie and Freddie side. And then the other remaining balance is on the bridge side, mostly non-recourse bridge. When you start getting into other commercial property types, you know, the focus really is on recourse bank loans until you get up to $5 million. So once you get above $5 million, there's really two options. One is the non-recourse bridge, which is what I did at GE Capital. And then the other one is CMBS. So CMBS is a non-recourse stabilized lender. So you can get, you know, 5 years or 10 years on your loan term versus just that shorter term 3 to 5 year bridge.
Perfect. Thanks for that. Thanks for that background. So if we're looking at what the basic process would look like for loan advisors or providers to source financing for qualified investors, give us a quick run through of how that process would look and what are things that each party must consider on both sides?
Yeah. So, I mean, really at the beginning of the process, what we need is sort of T12 rent roll, and sort of a budget from the potential purchaser. And then from there, you know, they're going to have to, we're going to vet that with different lenders, right? So we might, let's say it's on the multifamily side, we might take it to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and maybe a bridge lender and come back with terms. And then once the buyer says, okay, I'm going to go Fannie Mae, then that's really when the clock starts. They're going to put in a deposit to the lender. And it usually takes about 60 days to close. And throughout the 60 days, it really starts with third-party reports. So that's going to be engineering, environmental, appraisal. That's the first 2 weeks. And then the borrower is going to submit all their internal documents in terms of organizational structure, personal financial statement, credit authorization, those types of things. And then they'll submit it for approval usually around day, let's say 30. And then we're going to be going towards closing really day 45 to day 60. So that's at a high level. I wish every deal was that easy and that smooth, but usually there's something that comes up, right? Something comes up in the engineering report, something comes up in the appraisal that we sort of have to work through. And so that is, in an ideal world, 60 days from beginning to end.
Thank you. Thank you for that great overview. Obviously, that's in a perfect world, but that was a really good process from beginning to end, and, you know, how lenders are evaluating risk or what they're looking for and things like that. So appreciate you giving us an inside look there. So I want to move into kind of looking back at last year. Right? Everyone knows 2020 was a year for the books, right? So I want to ask your opinion, you know, what commercial real estate financing and investment trends emerged last year? And why do you think that that was the case? You know, was there more or fewer, maybe first-time investors versus in institutional investing? You know, what did you see last year?
So really in March, everything stopped. And so when I think the president and the NBA said, all right, we're gonna stop the season, everybody was like, whoa, what's going on? This is for real. So we had a lot of deals that were just getting started in March, and they all pretty much paused. So March, April, May, there was really nothing that came out. The only lenders on the multifamily side were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And what they said was, we'll give you a loan, but we're going to have you put up what we're calling COVID reserves. And that was essentially 10% of the loan amount. So you were getting a loan at 75%, but then we also want you to put up 10%. So let's say a $10 million loan, you had to put up $1 million on top of that. And so, most leverage was being cut about 10%. And then what we saw was in the multifamily side, you know, collections dipped a little bit. It probably went down 1-2% at the beginning. And then we saw, you know, sort of waves of stimulus. And that actually allowed people to pay their rent pretty easily. And so even though you couldn't evict people, people were still paying their rent. And so in July of last year, in the summer of last year, Fannie and Freddie said, all right, instead of 10%, we're going to drop it to 5%. And so that gave a lot people a lot more breathing room. And then people saw like, oh, actually in March, April, May, June, we collected 97-98% of the rent. And so we feel comfortable taking our deal back out to market. So we saw a flood of multifamily deals in the third quarter and fourth quarter of last year. And December of 2020 was actually the biggest month on multifamily sales, like since people started tracking it. So December was a huge month. Essentially, now people are back to sort of business as normal. With Biden elected and the amount of stimulus that they are putting out, people feel pretty comfortable in terms of the market where it sits right now. Fannie and Freddie have actually reduced it down. Now it's like 2.5%. So you can actually get even lower waivers, and it's really just about 6 months of interest that they're wanting you to put up for stable properties. So they started at 10%, dropped it to 5%, now it's 2.5%, which they're going in the right direction. But another reason that they're going in that direction is we talked about those non-recourse bridge lenders. And in March and April, they were non-existent. So if you wanted to do a bridge loan, you called around all the bridge lenders, you didn't get a call back. And then, I would say probably third quarter 2020, there was 1-2 people in that space, Q4, 5-10. And then now at the beginning of 2021, there's 20. So all those guys have come flooding back. And what's happened is, you know, one guy might say, all right, we'll do it at 4%. And the next guy says 3.75. The next guy says 3.5. And so the interest rate keeps getting lower and lower. And then people start comparing that to Fannie and Freddie. And the bridge lenders aren't requiring reserves. So then all of a sudden the bridge lenders are saying, are getting more aggressive. And so Fannie and Freddie are having to become less conservative, right? So the past year, they were the only people at the table. And so they controlled the terms. And so now we've seen these non-recourse bridge lenders come in, and that's caused the Fannie and Freddie to become a little bit less conservative.
Thank you for that overview. That was amazing. And I'm sure it was a roller coaster to be on your end, and a lot of change happened in such a short amount of time. So with that said, I mean, as we emerge from COVID, hopefully completely on the other end very soon, but what trends do you think will stick around for the long haul?
I mean, if you want to look from sort of the operator side, I would say some of the things around sort of virtual leasing in terms of digital, I think are here to stay, right? So people are used to now paying their rent online. They're used to not talking to anybody and leasing units. And so if you have a good presence online, that's going to help your property. In terms of investor, the biggest thing that changed was really the Fed's stance on interest rates. And so, you know, when we were going into COVID, you know, 10-year treasury was, you know, 1.5 to 2%, and it dropped all the way down to like 60 basis points. And so that drop in interest rate, along with the Fed dropping their rate, pretty much has, if you look at your savings account, pre-COVID versus now, basically you get $0 if your money's in a savings account, because the percentage of interest that you receive is so small that you cannot even see if there's a penny that they added, over the past month. And so, people are realizing now, okay, well, I'm not making any money on savings. I'm not making any money on bonds. I have to go out and put my money to work somehow. And so before, we were seeing returns anywhere from 15 to 20% IRR. And then you would try to maybe double your money if you put it in a deal, maybe in 5 years, right? And then it became, all right, maybe I can get 1.7 of an equity multiple over 5 years. But now it like keeps going down and down, and as people bid up higher prices, cap rates are coming down. And so the new normal, I think, for investors is now, you're probably in that 10 to 15% IRR. You're probably in the 5, 6, 7% cash on cash range versus a couple of years ago, you were probably 8, 9, 10% cash on cash. So I think investor returns are changing in terms of what they're demanding because the low interest rate environment.
Absolutely. And I you brought up a fantastic point and kind of leads me into one of the other topics and questions that I had for you. So recently, obviously, with Robinhood, we saw the rise of the retail investor, right, and got a good look at stock market volatility. So question for you, do you see an influx in capital or potentially new investors in entering the commercial real estate space or new ways for investors to purchase capital? So crowdsource REITs, et cetera, kind of talk me through what your thoughts are or predictions are on that.
I wish it was that easy. And I wish when I was in the stock market from 2005 to 2015, I essentially learned nothing in 10 years as a stock investor, because when I was at GE, even though I was like, quote unquote, in a CFO role, when you roll up a company of that size, you have no idea how to underwrite it at all. And that's what makes stock investing more difficult. I think you can get your hands around commercial real estate. What I think people have to be careful of is there's not as much liquidity, number one, and then just understanding the real estate that you're going to invest in. And so I think the education part is there's a lot more to go. And so I think people are looking at it as, well, in syndications that how most of the general partners I work with, they will syndicate a deal and it will be, they'll raise 50, 75, 100,000 per person, per investor. And that's going to be tied up for 3 to 5 years, typically. If you go to these crowdfunding platforms, you can invest $5,000, $10,000, $20,000. But I don't know how well you know the sponsor, right? And how well that deal's been underwritten. And so that's what you have to do on your own. There's definitely great deals on those platforms, but you're just going to have to vet through them and understand, still go back to the underwriting of these deals and understand them before you put your money in.
Absolutely. Back to that educational piece that we had talked about earlier. So, you know, obviously the world of commercial real estate can be very complex for newcomers. So based on your experience, you know, what's the number one piece of advice that you would give a new commercial real estate investor?
Number one, I would figure out what market and what property type you want to be in. And then really just go find a person in that market, in that property type that you want to be like, and pretty much go work for them for free. That would be my advice, because you will learn so much from that person and get exposed to so much more. And the challenge is that person probably doesn't want to talk to you. So you have to add value to that person somehow. And, you know, whether it's helping them find deals, whether it's helping them find equity, whether it's, you know, helping them put together a YouTube channel or helping them market their properties, something, you have to provide them some value so that they can help you. Because most people are not going to take the time, they can't help everybody. Right. And, you know, if I did a call with every single person who watched my video, I would never get anything done. So that's why you have to figure out a way to help that person and add value. And I think that's how you will learn immensely more than just online.
Absolutely. So I know that when we were watching some of your YouTube videos, you have one around build judgment. Will you tell us kind of an overview here shortly about what it means to do that and about your message in that YouTube video?
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of times people will email me and say, all right, can you look at this 50-page deck and tell me, should I invest in this deal or not? And it's pretty easy for me. If it's a multifamily deal in Texas, I can usually figure it out pretty quickly. But if you send me a retail or office or industrial deal in California or, you know, North Carolina, I'm lost, right? Because I'm not going to be able to tell you, all right, what are the rent comps? What are the sale comps? What's the best financing? Who's the operator? I don't know any of that. And so what the video around building judgment is that as you see more and more deals, as you see more and more transactions, your ability to see a good deal versus a bad deal. And the hardest thing for a investor is to see the things that are not in the pitch. Because what is not in the pitch is usually the problem, right? So there's a 50-page deck and 47 pages are on how great DFW is. Like, I already knew that, right? Like, tell me about the property. Tell me about the sponsorship. How much are they investing in the deal? How much are they charging in fees? You know, what if, you know, your bridge loan matures in 3 years? How are we going to get out of this deal? How much are you guys investing? Like, those are the questions I want answered, not, you know, how many people are moving to Dallas. I get that. I can see the traffic, right? So, That's the hard part in building judgment. And you can only really see it through, number one, deal exposure, and number two, asking the questions after the fact of seeing a webinar, after seeing a pitch. And so, I mean, a lot of times, I mean, I probably get anywhere from 5 to 10 investment pitches a week. And so I'll read through those, listen to those while I'm working out or riding the bike. And just listen to how people pitch their deal.
Absolutely. I love that. And you kind of have to put on your investigator hat, right? Do a little Sherlock Holmes with all of this, because everyone wants to put out all the good things, but you really have to look behind the curtain and find that information. That's fantastic. Now, you mentioned a couple of times, James, that you get a lot of pitches per week or a lot of questions off of your YouTube channel. So what are the most common questions you get from people that engage with your channel?
Most of the question I would say is, how do I get started? How do I get started as a general partner? How do I get started as a limited partner? So I will try to answer that as best as possible. From a general partner standpoint, almost every deal that I work on, it is not one person. It is typically a group of sponsors. And so you really have to start thinking about, how do you put together your group of sponsorship that is going to buy this deal? So whether it's a multifamily deal or industrial deal or office deal, you have to have, number one, somebody with previous experience in that product type. So we like to, if you're going to qualify for Fannie and Freddie, you're going to need somebody who has previous multifamily experience. So that's checkbox number one. Checkbox number two is, if you total up your net worth and liquidity of your sponsorship group, net worth needs to be equal to or greater than the loan amount. And then your liquidity, so after the down payment, you need at least 10%, probably 20% of the loan amount in post-close liquidity. So that's, checking, savings, marketable securities, non-retirement. So that's checkbox number two. And then number three is really around equity. Where's the equity going to come from? Do you already have the money? Are you going to syndicate it? Are you going to raise it from a crowdfunding platform? How are you going to put together your equity? And having those three questions answered, in whether it's a resume, whether it's proof of funds, whether it's a bank statement, that is what the listing broker is going to ask you right at the beginning, if they're a good listing broker, is, all right, how's the debt? How's the equity? And how are you going to put it together? And so that's really what I help general partners put together. Because usually when they come to me, they don't have all those pieces. And so you have to start figuring that out. On the limited partnership side, really you have to get to know operators, right? So you have to get to know operators, and you have to understand markets and property types. So I came in and I was like, all right, I want to learn multifamily. I want to learn self-storage. And I actually found self-storage pretty difficult to invest in on a syndication basis for me. I'm not saying it's impossible, but there's definitely self-storage funds, there's individual owners. And so that might've been a route for some people, but my route really came down to multifamily. And on the multifamily side, I really went and, I probably had coffee and lunch with 20 or 30 syndicators in the DFW area in 2014 and 2015. And what happens is, you start hearing the same names, right? So you ask every person I had lunch or coffee with, I would ask, who else should I talk with, right? So that's how it would end pretty much every conversation. And that would lead to the next introduction. And then it would just go on and on. And then eventually you get back to the beginning. And as you do that, and as you add more and more value to all these people, eventually you become the guy that people refer to.
Absolutely. And you've given such great advice here, James. I really appreciate you sharing this with our listeners. But, any other bits of advice? I know talking with everyone, providing value, kind of interning and working with them so that you become the household name. But what advice would you give individuals seeking to enter the financing sector specifically?
The short answer is, You have to know your stuff in terms of financing, but the people who probably do the best is having that combination of the financing know-how, but then you have to remember that you are in sales. And so, and the more and more you think about this, money is a commodity. And the same way that, there's a million chicken sandwiches, there's a reason that the line is around the door, around the street. The drive-through line is so long at Chick-fil-A. It's service, it's responsiveness, it's quality, it's all those things. And so as you grow in this business, remembering all those things and remembering to sort of build a brand for yourself and you know, do what you say you're going to do.
That was perfect. I love the last part. Do what you say you're going to do. The accountability and people being able to rely and trust on you based on your word is huge, not just in commercial real estate, but in everything. So that hit home. I loved you sharing that, James. And then lastly, any bit of advice in general, any other tidbits or nuggets of information that you want to share with our listeners when it comes to financing commercial real estate?
You know, I think I would definitely start with, you know, webinars, YouTubes, podcast, and start figuring out your niche, right? And become an expert somewhere. And I think that you can always, like some of the best general partners that I've worked with, they started in Dallas with, let's say, Class C apartments. And then as they went and got into bigger properties, Class B and then Class A, and then they got into development. Then they went from Dallas, then they did Austin, then added Houston. But be good at one thing first. And so that's what I would challenge people to be at, is become an expert in one niche. And, you know, you can read a blog post, two blog posts that I'll recommend is The Long Tail, and then also 1,000 True Fans. So 1,000 True Fans by Kevin Kelly. He talks about, you know, in today's day and age, with the internet, you only need 1,000 true fans. And if you have 1,000 investors or 1,000 followers, then you can make a living and do very well in that market and in that niche. And so people will find you, but you have to become an expert at something.
Absolutely. I love that. The phrase jack of all trades and master of none comes to mind when you think about that. And when you try to spread yourself thin and, you know, have your hand in all of these other things. So absolutely find what you're passionate about, get in that niche and become that expert that people seek and want advice from. So, well, with that, that is the end of our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, James. It's great to hear your insights, especially on such complex and important topics. So we truly appreciate your time today. I know you're very busy. So thanks again for taking the time to sit down with us. Now, James, where can people find you online if they want to get in touch? Maybe your email or your social media?
Yeah. I mean, our company's website is oldcapitallending.com. You can go there to see sort of recent transactions and register for our next event there. You can type my name, YouTube, or just put in multifamily YouTube. And multifamily financing YouTube, that I'll show up. And, you know, my email is jeng at oldcapitallending.com. And I'm happy to answer any questions via email.
Perfect. Thank you so much, James. And thanks for everyone who tuned in today. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexy.com/podcast and sign up to get the next episode delivered straight to your inbox. Of course, you can also subscribe to the Crexy podcast on your favorite podcast app and check out our YouTube channel for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and be sure to tune in next time.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexy.com/podcast. That's go.crexy.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexy podcast on your favorite podcast app. Or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexy for video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and we'll see you next time.